Time for my favorite godson. I want to try out a new 60-year-old port that I ordered from Portugal. I hope you'll join me.
I'll be there in 15 minutes.
Pitt drove down a tree-lined street in Georgetown until he reached a spacious carriage house that had been expanded into a home with a two-story basement that housed the largest library on the sea ever amassed by one individual. A huge man who weighed 400 pounds, wearing burgundy paisley silk pajamas under a matching robe, filled the doorway. His girth was solid, and he moved with an unexpected grace. His flowing hair was gray, as was his long beard, beneath a rosy red tulip nose and deep sky blue eyes.
"Dirk!"
He crushed Pitt in a tight hug and stepped back.
"Come in, come in. I don't see enough of you anymore."
Pitt followed St. Julian Perlmutter through rooms and hallways stacked floor to high ceilings with books on ships and the sea. As they sipped the port, Pitt explained what he was looking for. "I thought that if anybody knew about Captain Nemo's submarine, the Nautilus, it had to be you." Perlmutter leaned back and stared at the ornate ceiling above his kitchen.
"It's been a few years since I reread the story. Verne was either way ahead of his time or he could see into the future, because the Nautilus was extremely technically advanced for 1866.
Could someone or some country have built a submarine that might have been half as efficient as the Nautilus?" asked Pitt.
"The only one that I recall that was proven practical before the 1890s was the Confederate submarine H.L. Hunley."
"I remember," said Pitt. "She sank a Union sloop of war called the Housatonic outside of Charleston, South Carolina, in 1864, and became the first submarine in history to sink a warship." Perlmutter nodded.
"The Hunley sat buried in the silt for 136 years before she was discovered, raised, and placed in a conservation laboratory tank to preserve her for public display. When she was inspected and the silt and remains of her crew removed from inside, she was found to be far more modern in concept than was supposed. The Hunley even experimented with electromagnetic engines, but that technology was not ready, so 8 men sat inside the submarine and turned a crank that spun the propeller for propulsion."
Perlmutter ran out of steam and was about to reach for the port bottle again when a look of revelation swept over his face.
"I just thought of something," he said, raising his great bulk out of his chair with ease.
He disappeared down the hall for several minutes before reappearing with a book in one hand.
"A copy of the Board of Inquiry Minutes concerning the sinking of the U.S. Navy frigate Kearsarge."
"The ship that sank the Confederate raider Alabama?"
"The same. I'd forgotten the strange circumstances behind her grounding on Roncador Reef off Venezuela in 1894.
"Strange?" asked Pitt.
"Yes. According to her commander, Captain Lee Hunt, he was attacked by a man-made underwater vessel that resembled a whale. The vessel rammed the Kearsarge, putting a large hole in her hull. She barely made it to Roncador Reef before she grounded."
"Sounds like the good captain was heavily into the rum locker," Pitt said jokingly.
"No, he was dead serious," replied Perlmutter. "And what's important is that his entire crew backed him up. Their testimony described a steel monster that was impenetrable to a series of cannon shots the Kearsarge poured into it. They simply bounced off. They also mentioned some sort of pyramid-shaped tower on its back that appeared to have viewing ports. Captain Hunt swore that he saw a face staring back at him through one of the ports, a man with a beard. Perhaps Jules Verne heard of such a vessel and created Captain Nemo and his Nautilus around it."
"What about Verne?" Pitt inquired. "There must be a museum that collected all his papers, research records, and letters."
"There are. Verne's scholars exist everywhere. But Dr. Paul Héroux, president of the Society of Jules Verne in Amiens, France, which was Verne's home from 1872 until he died in 1905, is considered the most knowledgeable man on the author's life."
Can we contact him?
Better yet, said Perlmutter. In a few days, I plan to travel to Paris to dig through an archive for information on John Paul Jones's ship, the Bonham Richard. I'll run up to Amiens and talk with Dr. Heru.
The Knox Inn, in the little town of Rose Hill, had been a stagecoach stop as far back as 1772. Now it was a restaurant that served country-style gourmet dishes. Pitt, Giordino, Lauren, and Kelly were immediately shown by the maitre d' to a nice table in the courtyard beneath a large oak tree. They ordered an assortment of barbecued pork and chicken, grits with shrimp and crab, a southern coleslaw salad, and corn on the cob. They were having key lime pie for dessert when a man with a tanned face and reddish-brown hair, flanked by two deadpan characters who might as well have worn signs that proclaimed them as armed killers, approached their table. As the man walked across the courtyard, his blue-white eyes locked on Pitt. An alarm went off in Pitt's brain. He tapped Giordino's leg with his foot and made a gesture that the stocky Italian immediately recognized. The man came directly to their table and stopped.
We have never met, Mr. Pitt, but my name is Curtis Merlinzale.
They were all well familiar with the name. Their reaction at seeing the legendary monster in the flesh varied. Kelly sucked in her breath and her eyes widened. Lauren explored him with amused curiosity, while Giordino's interest was focused on the two bodyguards. Pitt gazed at Zale with studied indifference and made no effort to rise to his feet. Zale gave a short, aristocratic bow as he addressed the ladies.
Miss Egan, Congresswoman Smith, it is a pleasure to finally meet you.
Then he turned to Pitt and Giordino.
Gentlemen, you are uncommonly stubborn. Your meddling has caused my company a great deal of frustration.
Your reputation as a greed-driven sociopath precedes you, said Pitt acidly.
The two bodyguards took a step forward, but Zale gestured them back.
I had hoped we might have a congenial conversation of benefit to us all, he said without a sign of malice.
This guy is smooth, Pitt thought to himself.
Smooth and slippery as a snake-oil con man.
I fail to see what we have in common. You murder men, women, and children. Al and I are just your common, law-abiding, tax-paying citizens who became swept up in your crackpot scheme to create a domestic oil monopoly.
It will never happen, said Lauren.
If Zale was dismayed that Pitt and Lauren were aware of his grand design, he didn't show it.
You realize, of course, that my resources far exceed yours. You're delusional if you think you're bigger than the U.S. government, argued Lauren. Congress will stop you before any of your plans get off the ground. First thing in the morning, I'm calling for a full congressional investigation into your involvement with the Emerald Dolphin and Golden Marlin disasters.
Zale gave her a patronizing smile.
Are you sure that's wise? No politician is immune from scandal or accidents.
Are you threatening me? Lauren hissed.
Zale did not alter his smile.
Why no, Congresswoman Smith. Simply pointing out the possibilities.
Lauren's eyes blazed. When it's revealed who you paid off and how much, you and your cohorts will be indicted on more criminal charges than John Gotti.
Zale gave an imperious nod of his head.
I do not think so.
I couldn't agree with Mr. Zale more, said Pitt casually. He will never stand trial.
You have more intelligence than I gave you credit for, said Zale.
No, Pitt continued. You will never be convicted of your crimes because you will most certainly die first. No man deserves to die more than you, Zale, along with every murdering scum in your viper gang.
There was a hairline crack in Zale's composure.
I take care, Mr. Pitt. You seem too well informed yourself ever to become a senior citizen. Now that I know where I stand, I shall leave you to your dessert, but my friends here will remain.
What does he mean? Asked Kelly fearfully.
He means that as soon as he is on his way down the highway, safe in his limousine, his flunkies intend to shoot us. Here? In front of all these people? Queried Giardino. And without masks? Your flair for drama is pretty tawdry.
Caution was edging around Zale's blue-white eyes. These men were not reacting in the way he'd expected. These men were not afraid of death. His normally decisive mind was at a dead end, and it was not an experience he relished.
Now that we've seen the face of the enemy, Pitt said, I suggest you leave the inn while you can still walk, and don't even think of harming Miss Egan or anyone else at this table.
Zale controlled his anger superbly. He nodded at his two bodyguards and turned to leave.
Before you run off, said Pitt, it might be wise to take your pals with you, or they'll follow in an ambulance.
Zale turned back and stared at Pitt as his men stepped forward and reached inside their suit coats. As if rehearsed, Pitt and Giardino lifted their weapons from beneath the table where they had been resting in their laps under napkins.
Goodbye, Mr. Zale, Giardino murmured with a tight smile. Next time. And his voice trailed off.
The assassins glanced at each other uneasily. It didn't take Mensa intelligence to know that they would be dead men before they could draw their own weapons.
I apologize for calling you fools, said Zale, spreading his hands harmlessly. It seems you came to dinner fully equipped.
Al and I were Eagle Scouts, said Pitt. We like to be prepared.
He nonchalantly turned his back on Zale and dipped his fork into his key lime pie.
I hope that when we meet again, you're strapped to a table receiving a lethal injection.
Marlis Kaiser stepped from her kitchen onto the porch as she heard the thumping sound of a helicopter approaching her farm outside Monticello, Minnesota. She greeted her visitors, Pitt, Giardino, and Kelly, and invited them inside.
Father never explained his interest in runestone inscriptions, Kelly explained. Mother and I went along on his excursions to find them, but we were more interested in the fun of camping and hiking than searching for old rocks with writing on them.
Dr. Egan's library was filled with books on Vikings, but didn't have any of his notes and reports, added Pitt.
Norseman, Mr. Pitt, Marlis corrected him. Viking is a term for sea-roving raiders who were fearless and fierce in battle. Centuries later, they probably would have been called pirates or buccaneers. The Viking Age was launched when they raided the Lindisfarne Monastery in England in 793. From 800 on, Viking fleets roamed throughout Europe and the Mediterranean. Their reign was short and their power faded by the 13th century.
Any idea why so many Norse rune stones have been found around the Midwest? Inquired Giardino.
Norse sagas tell of the seafaring people of Iceland and Greenland who tried to colonize the northeast coast of the United States around 1000 AD. We must assume they launched expeditions of exploration into our heartland. They could have used the inland river systems to explore vast regions of the country.
As indicated by the stones with runic inscriptions they left behind, offered Giardino.
As I told you over the phone, said Pitt, we are investigating Kelly's father's fascination with a series of runestones he discovered and studied 15 years ago. Dr. Egan's studies concerned a series of 35 inscriptions that told of a group of Norsemen who explored the Midwest in 1035 AD, Marlis said. I recall he was obsessed with the inscriptions in the hope they would lead him to a cave. Where, I have no idea.
Do you have any records of them?
Marlis clapped her hands.
This is your lucky day. Come out to my office in the barn where I have them filed away.
What was once a barn built for a dairy herd had been converted into a giant office. One side of the spacious room was filled with artifacts, ceramic bowls shaped into pots, human heads and figures, and animals. At least 100 smaller artifacts were preserved in a great glass case. After searching, Marlis laid down a photograph of a large inscribed rock. She was standing next to it for perspective.
This is the Bertram Stone, found by a hunter in 1933 on the other side of the lake behind the farm.
Then she went to a tall cabinet and removed a plaster mold she had made of the stone.
How do you know the writing stone isn't fake? The question came from Giardino, a worldly skeptic.
A number of reasons, Marlis answered sweetly. One, Police forgery experts have examined several of the stones and unanimously agreed that the carved inscriptions were made by the same hand. All characteristics are identical. 2. Who would travel 2,000 miles around the country carving runic inscriptions about a Norse exploration expedition if it never happened? For what purpose? Also, if they were fake, they were made by someone who was a master of the language and alphabet, as attested to by modern experts on runology, who found no incorrect variations in the letters. 3. The Bertram runestone was first discovered, according to local historians, by a tribe of Ojibwans who told early settlers about it in 1820. It was next recorded by French fur trappers. It seems extremely unlikely that someone else carved the stones long before the area was settled. And finally, 4. Although carbon dating analysis only works with organic materials and not with stone, the only method to judge aging is to study the amount of erosion on the rock over the years. Judging from the wear and tear on the rock from wind, rain, and snow, the letters were dated between 1000 and 1150 AD, which seems reasonable.
"Here's the million-dollar question," Giordino asked Marlis. "What does the stone say?"
Marlis took a CD disc and inserted it in her terminal. In a moment, the letters were revealed in great detail on the monitor. There were 4 lines of almost 30 letters. "We may never have a totally accurate translation," she said, "but 6 runologists from here in Scandinavia agree that the inscription reads, Magnus Sigvatsson passed this way in year 1035 and claimed the lands this side of the river for his brother, Bjarn Sigvatsson, leader of our tribe, Helgen Sigtrygg, murdered by Skraelings." Skraelings translates to barbarians or lazy heathen, or in the old vernacular, wretches. We must assume that Sigtrygg was killed during a clash with local native Indians, the early ancestors of the Sioux and Ojibwe. "Magnus Sigvatsson." Pitt spoke the name softly, accenting each syllable. "Brother of Bjarn." Marlis sighed thoughtfully. "There is a saga that mentions Bjarn Sigvatsson along with several boatloads of colonists setting off from Greenland toward the west. Later sagas claim Sigvatsson and his people were swallowed up by the sea and never seen again." "The other 34 stones?" said Pitt. "What do they reveal?" "Most of them seem to be boundary markers. Magnus was quite ambitious. He claimed a quarter of what became the United States for his brother Bjarn and his tribe." "And where were the other runestones found?" asked Kelly. "The first and last was discovered at Crown Point on the southern end of Lake Champlain. Stone inscriptions were also found on a meandering course through Iowa, Missouri, Arkansas, and Kansas. The farthest stone was found by a Boy Scout troop near Sterling, Colorado." Kelly looked puzzled. "I'm unclear as to what you mean by the first and last stone." "As close as we can tell, the Lake Champlain runestone was the first inscribed at the beginning of the expedition. When they returned nearly a year later, they made a second inscription on the stone below the first." "May we see them?" Pitt asked. Marlis typed on her keyboard, and a large stone appeared on the monitor. Above 10 rows of inscriptions was carved the petroglyph of a Viking ship, complete with sails, oars, and shields on the sides. "This is a tough one," said Marlis. "None of the epigraphists who studied the stone have agreed 100% on the message, but the translations are fairly similar in text." She then began to translate the lengthy inscription. "After 6 days' travel up the fjord from our families at the settlement, Magnus Sigvatsson and his 100 comrades rest here and claim all the land within sight of the water for my kinsman and leader of our tribe, Bjarn Sigvatsson, and our children. The land is far larger than we knew. We are well provisioned, and our 5 small ships are stout and in good repair. We will not come back this way many months. May Odin protect us from the Skraelings." She went on, "I must warn you that the translations are very vague and probably do not convey the original meaning. The second inscription carved on the return reads,
14 months after leaving our families, we are but a few days' sail down the fjord to the cave below the high cliffs to our homes. Of the 100, we are now 95. Bless Odin for protecting us. The land I claimed in my brother's name is larger than we have known. We have discovered paradise. Magnus Sigvatsson. Then there is a date of 1036.
6 days' sail down the fjord, Pitt repeated pensively. That would suggest the Norsemen had a settlement in the United States.
Has a site ever been discovered? Asked Jordino.
Marla shook her head. Archaeologists have yet to find one below Newfoundland. Pitt looked at Kelly. Your father knew where it was.
What makes you say that?
Why else would he become so fanatical in his search for the runestones? My guess is that he was searching for the cave mentioned in the final inscription. The reason he suddenly dropped his research is because he must have found it.
Down in the lavishly furnished basement conference room at Tohono Lake, 6 men and 2 women sat opposite one another around a circular conference table. The 9th person, Curtis Merlin Zale, was seated at one end. He passed out several leather-bound folders and leaned back in his chair.
"Commit what you read to memory," he directed. "When we leave tomorrow evening, all paperwork and notes will be destroyed."
It was vital to the interests of the Cerberus Empire that the strategy planning session be held in the strictest secrecy. The men and women seated at the table were CEOs of the largest oil companies in the Northern Hemisphere and had congregated to map strategy for the coming months.
"You all know the predictions," said Zale as he began the meeting. "Between 1975 and 2000, the world's population grew 50%. The demand for crude oil followed suit. By 2010, the world's total oil production will peak. From then until 2050, production will drop to a small fraction of what it is today."
The 46-year-old head of Zena Oil, Rick Sherman, led the nation's third largest oil producer, third only to the parent company Cerberus, peered at Zale through thick, rimless glasses.
"Statistics are already coming up short. A permanent oil shortage has begun 10 years ahead of the predictions. Production, which will skid steeply from now on."
Jesus Morales, the CEO of the Caltex Oil Company, said,
"Prices will skyrocket, accompanied by hyperinflation and even rationing. I shudder to think what level transportation costs will hit."
"I agree." Sally Morse polished her reading glasses and studied Zale's report. The chief of Yukon Oil, Canada's largest oil producer, she'd been the last to reluctantly join the secret cabal 5 years earlier, but she was beginning to have second thoughts.
"There will be no major finds in the future. As these fields diminish, oil and gas prices will rise on a steep curve."
"It's as though the entire situation were falling into our hands," said Zale. "By pooling our resources, our fields and refineries in North America, we can dictate our own terms. We can also double production by drilling where the government has not allowed us to go before. Our new pipeline systems will carry the oil overland without the expensive use of tankers. If our strategy works, the only oil and gas sold north of Mexico will be American and Canadian. To put it in simple terms, 96% of the income will go to enhance the profit of our respective organizations."
Morales leaned his chair back on 2 legs and placed his hands on the back of his head.
"Now all that is left before we can begin our operation is the final completion of our oil pipeline system."
Zale nodded at Delage, who pressed a button on a remote control that lowered a large screen. A large map of Alaska, Canada, and the lower 48 states filled the screen. A series of black lines traveled across national and state borders from oil fields to refineries to major cities. Zale continued.
"Ladies and gentlemen, our oil transportation system. 37,000 miles of underground pipeline.
The final line from Sam Riley's Pioneer Oil Fields in Nebraska, Wyoming, Kansas, and the Dakotas will be ready to send oil by the end of the month.
Circumventing the environmentalists by laying pipe underground was a brilliant stroke, said Sam Riley, head of Pioneer Oil Company.
I must admit it saved untold billions in litigation and hassles with public and private landowners, acknowledged Zale. It also allows us to pump oil directly into every major city without having to worry about strict governmental regulations.
Guy Cruz looked at Zale. I understand a congressional committee led by Lauren Smith is launching an investigation into Cerberus.
Smith's probe will go nowhere, Zale asserted firmly.
How can you be so sure? Asked Morse. Lauren Smith is one member of Congress who definitely is not on our side.
Zale looked at her, his eyes cold.
The matter will be handled.
Dan Goodman raised his hand. I, for one, applaud your successful campaign to enrage the general public against foreign oil coming into the United States. For decades, no one cared where their fuel supplies were coming from. But with the supertanker disasters your Viper Group caused in Fort Lauderdale, Newport Beach, Boston, and Vancouver, where millions of gallons of oil spills invaded highly populated and affluent areas of the country, public outcry to become self-sufficient in oil has soared.
Morse held her head in her hands. When I think of all the people, the birds, animals, and fish that have died for us to achieve our goal, it makes me ill.
Now is not the time for conscience, Zale admonished her. We are in an economic war. There may be no need for generals or tanks or nuclear bombers, but to win, we have to supply the public's insatiable appetite for fuel. Soon, very soon, we will be in a position to tell every person living north of Mexico what fuel to buy, when to buy, and how much to pay for it. In time, our efforts will replace a governmental state with a corporate state.
We cannot weaken now, Sally.
We need one more incident to push them over the edge, said Sherman.
A fox-like grin cut Zale's features. I'm one jump ahead of you, Rick. Such an incident will take place 3 days from now.
Another tanker spill?
Far worse.
On Saturday, at approximately 4:30 in the early evening, an ultra-large crude carrier, the Pacific Trojan, the largest oil tanker in the world, will enter San Francisco Bay. She will make for the Point San Pedro mooring, where she would normally discharge her cargo, only she will not stop. She will continue toward the central section of the city at full speed, driving ashore at the ferry building's World Trade Center. Estimates are that she will plow nearly 2 blocks into the city before coming to rest. Then charges will be detonated, and 620,000 tons of oil will go up in an explosion that will devastate the entire San Francisco waterfront area.
"Oh, my God," muttered Sally Morse, her face suddenly pale. "How many people will die?"
"Could be in the thousands, since it takes place during the rush hour," answered Cruz, callously. Congresswoman Lauren Smith felt as though she'd been tied to a wild horse and dragged across a desert. Though the directors of Cerberus had been subpoenaed to appear before her Congressional Investigative Committee into illegal marketing practices, they had failed to show. Instead, they were represented by an army of their corporate attorneys, who laid an impenetrable smokescreen over the entire proceedings.
"Spin and stall tactics," she muttered under her breath, as she gaveled the hearings to a close until the following morning.
Congressman Leonard Sturgis, a Democrat from North Dakota, walked up and put a hand on her shoulder. "Don't be discouraged, Lauren."
"I can't say that you were much help today," she said, with a hard edge to her voice. "You agreed with everything they threw at us, when you knew perfectly well it was nothing but distortions and lies."
"You can't deny that everything they testified about was perfectly legal."
"I want to see Curtis Merlin Zale in front of the committee, along with his board of directors, not a bunch of shysters throwing mud in the water."
"I'm sure Mr. Zale will appear at the proper time," said Sturgis. "I think you will find him a reasonable man."
Lauren gave him a withering look. Zale crudely interrupted my dinner the other night. Your reasonable man threatened my life if I didn't drop the investigation.
I find that hard to accept.
Believe it, Lauren said nastily. Take my advice, Leo. Distance yourself from Cerberus. They're going down, and going down big time. That evening, when Lauren reached her townhouse in Alexandria and clicked the remote to her garage door, a woman stepped from the shadows and approached her. Lauren rolled down her window.
Congresswoman Smith, forgive the intrusion, but it's most urgent that we talk.
Who are you?
My name is Sally Morse. I am the chairman of Yukon Oil Company.
Lauren studied the woman, who was dressed in denim slacks with a light blue cotton sweater. There was a sincerity in the eyes that appealed to Lauren.
Step into the garage.
In the living room, Lauren poured a shot of Cutty Sark over ice and handed it to Sally. Then she opened a Coors beer and sat across a coffee table from her.
Now, Miss Morse, why come to me?
Because you're heading the congressional investigation into the Cerberus Empire. Morse took a large swallow of the scotch.
I hope you'll understand something. From this moment on, my life is in extreme danger. My property will likely be destroyed, and my reputation and my position that I worked so hard to achieve will be scourged.
And then she told Lauren about Zale's devious plan. She concluded, Curtis Merlin Zale has paid out more than $5 billion to buy everyone in Washington that he can profit from. Over 100 senators and representatives are in his pocket, along with officials in every department of government.
Can you name names? Lauren asked intently.
Sally pulled a computer disk from her purse.
It's all here.
Congressman Leonard Sturgis?
He's on the list.
I was afraid of that, Lauren said angrily. Lauren and Sally talked until nearly 3 o'clock in the morning.
You can stay here for the night, but we've got to find you a safe hideout while the investigation is underway, Lauren said.
Once Zale discovers you're going to blow the whistle on his insidious operation, he'll make every effort to silence you.
After Kelly left the aircraft in Washington, she was escorted to an unmarked van that transported her to Lauren's house. Pitt and Giardino entered a Numa Lincoln Navigator and relaxed as the driver steered the car toward Landover, Maryland. 20 minutes later, they drove into the vast parking lot of FedEx Field, the stadium that is home to the Washington Redskins football team. The Navigator rolled into the underground VIP parking area and stopped by a doorway guarded by 2 security men in combat gear. They studied Pitt and Giardino's faces with photographs provided to them by Numa's security department before allowing them to pass into a long corridor that stretched beneath the stadium.
Fourth door on the left, gentlemen, instructed one of the guards.
They were mildly surprised to find themselves in the locker room for visiting football teams. Several people were already seated in the team management office. Lauren was there with Sally Morse. Admiral Sandecker, Rudy Gunn, and Hiram Yeager represented Numa. Pitt recognized Admiral Amos Dover of the Coast Guard, Captain Warren Garnett of the Marines, and Commander Miles Jacobs, who was a veteran of Navy SEAL operations. He and Giardino had worked with all of them in the past. Admiral Sandecker also introduced Wes Rader, a senior deputy director at the Justice Department, who would coordinate all activities from the legal end.
Admiral, said Rader, I'm at a loss as to why we're playing all these security games. Meeting in the locker room of a football stadium seems a bit overdone.
You'll have your question answered as soon as Ms. Morse makes her report. Sandecker nodded at Sally. Please begin.
For the next 2 hours, Sally gave a detailed narrative of Curtis Merlin Zale's scheme to create an oil monopoly and gain enormous wealth while dictating terms to the United States government. When she finished, there was a heavy cloud of incredulity in the room. Finally, Wes Rader spoke.
Are you certain what you've told us is true?
Every word, Sally said resolutely.
Our first priority, said Sandecker, is to stop that oil tanker from wiping out half of San Francisco.
He turned to Dover, Garnett, and Jacobs.
This is where you gentlemen come into the picture.
The Coast Guard will stop the Pacific Trojan from entering the bay, Dover stated flatly. Sandecker nodded.
Sounds simple, Amos. You've stopped thousands of ships carrying everything from drugs to illegal immigrants to smuggled weapons. But stopping the world's largest super oil tanker will take more than firing a shot across its bow and a command through a bullhorn.
Dover smiled at Garnett and Jacobs.
Is this why we have the Navy SEALs and Marine Recon at the table?
You will, of course, be in command of the operation, said Sandecker. But if the captain of the tanker ignores your commands to heave to and continues on his course into the bay, we don't have a whole lot of avenues open to us. The ship must be stopped outside the Golden Gate, but to fire on her and risk causing a monstrous oil spill is out of the question. As a last resort, a combat team will have to be airdropped by helicopter onto the vessel to neutralize the crew.
Where is the Pacific Trojan now? Asked Dover.
Approximately 900 miles out.
That gives us less than 48 hours.
Unknown to Pitt, his days of lonely bachelorhood would be temporarily interrupted. He returned to his hangar and observed that wily old Sandecker had sent a security team to patrol the area at the deserted end of the airport. He didn't question the Admiral's concern for his safety. But the music coming out of his stereo was on an easy listening station instead of his preferred modern jazz. Then he smelled the aroma of coffee. He peered into the kitchen and found Morse stirring the contents of an array of pots on the stove.
Who invited you? Who said you could invade my personal domain as if you owned it? Who let you in through the security systems? All these questions ripened in his mind. But mild-mannered marine engineer that he was, Pitt simply said,
Hello, what's for dinner?
Beef stroganoff, answered Sally, turning and smiling sweetly. Do you like it?
One of my favorites.
She could tell by the adrift expression on his face that he hadn't expected her.
Congresswoman Smith thought I'd be safer staying here, especially since Admiral Sandecker has placed a security ring around your hangar. His bedroom looked as if a bomb had gone off. Shoes and various items of female apparel littered the polished wooden plank floor. The bathroom door was ajar, so he eased it open with his toe. Kelly was standing in front of a half-steamed mirror, wearing a towel around her body and a smaller one wrapped around her head. She was putting on eye makeup. She saw Pitt's blank stare in the mirror and smiled engagingly.
Welcome home. I hope Sally and I haven't upset your routine.
It was suggested you stay here, too?
He asked.
Lauren thought it safer than her place, and the government safe houses couldn't be trusted because of Zale's infiltration into the Justice Department.
Don't mind me,
Pitt said wryly. I'll pack some clothes and shower downstairs in the guest quarters.
Sally had stepped from the kitchen.
I fear we have inconvenienced you.
I'll survive, Pitt said, as he began throwing some things in an overnight bag. You ladies make yourselves at home.
Pitt set up house in the Manhattan Limited Pullman Railroad car that sat on rails along one wall of the hangar. He used it as a guest quarters when visitors and friends stayed with him. Giordino often borrowed it for the night when he wanted to impress one of his lady friends. He had stepped from the shower and was shaving when the extension phone in the Pullman rang.
Dirk!
St. Julian Perlmutter's voice boomed in his ear.
I'm in Amiens. I spent the day talking to Vern Scholars. Tomorrow I have an appointment with Dr. Paul Heroux.
Discover any new revelations about Captain Nemo and the Nautilus?
Nothing beyond what Vern wrote in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and its sequel, The Mysterious Island.
From what I gathered from Dr. Egan's research, Pitt said, he seemed fascinated by how the author created Nemo and his submarine. I think Egan thought Vern built the story around a real person.
Chapter 16 of The Mysterious Island, Perlmutter recited. Nemo was born the son of a Raja in India. Vern described him as growing up handsome, extremely wealthy, and full of hatred for the British who conquered his country. On a remote, uninhabited island in the Pacific, he used his wealth to build a shipyard, where he created the Nautilus.
Nemo harnessed electricity long before Tesla and Edison built their generators. The engines in the submarine powered the boat indefinitely without the need of refueling or regeneration.
Makes me wonder if Verne didn't envision Dr. Egan's magneto-hydrodynamic engines.
After completing his undersea vessel, continued Perlmutter, he brought on a loyal crew and vanished under the sea. Then in 1867 he took on three castaways who had fallen off an American Navy frigate he had attacked. They recorded his secret existence and voyaged around the world with him underwater. The castaways escaped when the Nautilus sailed into the maelstrom and Nemo disappeared. Alone with his beloved submarine, he spent his final years in a cavern beneath a volcano on Lincoln Island. After aiding castaways on the island against pirates and helping them to sail home, he died of natural causes. The volcano then erupted, and Lincoln Island sank beneath the sea, burying Captain Nemo and his extraordinary Nautilus in the depths, where they are now enshrined in fictional history.
But was it fiction, Pitt mused, or based on nonfiction? In the Cerberus offices in Washington, Curtis Merlin Zale was studying a geologist's seismic reports on an oil and gas field in Idaho. He did not look up as an electrician entered carrying a long box containing fluorescent light tubes. Instead of installing the light tubes, the man boldly sat down in a chair in front of the desk. Only then did Zale look up into the dark, sinister eyes of Omo Kanai.
"Was your distrust validated?" asked Kanai.
Zale smiled smugly.
"The unsuspecting fish took the bait."
"May I ask who?"
"Sally Morse of Yukon Oil. A loose cannon in the capital could be dangerous."
Zale shook his head.
"She has no documentation, only her word. Nothing can be proved. Little does she suspect that she did us a great service by turning renegade and defecting." "And where will you be during the Holocaust tomorrow?" Kanai asked. A sharp grin curled Zale's lips. "I will be testifying before Congresswoman Smith."
When Lauren walked from her office in the Congressional Office Building into the hearing room, she was stunned as she stared at the table reserved for those subpoenaed to appear before her committee. There was no army of Cerberus corporate attorneys, no platoon of company directors or officials. Curtis Merlin Zale sat alone behind the table. She exchanged looks with Congressman Leonard Sturgis. His face appeared strained, as if he was leery of having to ask tough questions of Zale. Lauren said a few preliminary words to open the investigation and thanked Zale for appearing. Then Lorraine Hope, a heavy black woman from the Galveston shore of Texas, launched the proceedings. Lauren knew that Hope's name was not on the list of those bought off by Cerberus, but she couldn't be positive of Hope's views on the company.
"Mr. Zale, is it your position that the United States would be far better off if we became self-sufficient in domestic oil and did not require the importing of foreign crude from the Middle East and Latin America?" "Oh, God," thought Lauren. "She's playing right into his hands." "Our reliance on foreign oil," began Zale, "is draining the economy. For the past 50 years, OPEC has played with market prices like a yo-yo. The only way to stop this madness is to develop our own fields and not have to rely on outside oil."
"You make a strong case," said Congressman Sturgis. "I, for one, lean toward your scenario. I have always been against blackmail by the foreign oil cartels. If American oil companies can supply the country's needs without leaving our shores, I'm in favor of it."
The questions were given out, and the answers returned. Zale, Lauren could see, was not about to be daunted. He well knew that he controlled 3 of the 5 members on the Unfair Practices Committee, and he felt in total control. It was an hour before dawn when the Coast Guard cutter Huron, running at full speed, intercepted the gargantuan supertanker Pacific Trojan, 20 miles west of the Golden Gate.
Two Coast Guard helicopters circled the big ship, accompanied by the latest addition to Marine Air, a Goshawk copter that carried Captain Garnett and his 30-man Marine recon team. A fast armored Army patrol boat followed at the stern of the tanker. On board were Commander Miles Jacobs and his Navy SEAL team, prepared to shoot grappling hooks attached to ladders onto the vast deck of the tanker. Captain Buck Compton, commander of the Huron, got permission from the tanker's captain to board for an inspection. Admiral Dover, who was in charge of the boarding operation, climbed to the deck along with the crew from the assault teams commanded by Jacobs and Garnett.
"This ship has been reported to be carrying explosives," said Dover to the Trojan's outraged captain, Don Walsh. "We are making a routine inspection to verify."
"Explosives?" burst Walsh. "Are you crazy? This is an oil tanker. No one in their right mind would bring explosives on board."
"That's what we intend to find out," Dover replied calmly.
"Your report is ridiculous. Where did it come from?"
"From a high-level official at Cerberus Oil."
"What has Cerberus Oil got to do with anything? Pacific Trojan belongs to the Berwick Shipping Company of Great Britain. We transport oil and chemical products for any number of foreign clients."
"Whose oil are you carrying?" asked Dover.
"This voyage, it belongs to Zandak Oil of Indonesia."
"Team 1 reporting," came Garnett's voice over Dover's radio. "We can find no sign of explosive devices in the engine room or stern superstructure."
An hour passed while Captain Walsh fumed and paced the bridge in frustration, knowing that each passing minute the ship was delayed cost his company many thousands of dollars. Then Jacobs reported in.
"She's clean, Admiral. We found no trace of explosive material."
Dover was beginning to harbor large doubts about Sally Morse's truthfulness, but he was also vastly relieved to find that the ship had no intention of blowing up half of San Francisco. Pitt was seated at his desk, clearing it of Numa business before flying to Elmore Egan's farm, when Admiral Sandecker abruptly walked past his secretary and entered his office. Before Pitt could say a word, Sandecker snarled,
"Zale threw us a red herring."
"I'm sorry?" replied Pitt, confused.
"The Pacific Trojan came up empty. Admiral Dover just reported in. There were no explosives on board. The ship was clean. Either we were duped, or Sally Morse was hallucinating."
"I trust Sally. I prefer to think we were duped."
"All right," said Sandecker. "I'll go along with your thinking, but where does it lead?"
"I'm counting on Hiram Yeager and Max to come up with the answer," Pitt said. Pitt, with Sandecker two steps behind, rushed into Yeager's office.
"Hiram, the Admiral and I need you and Max to launch a new probe as quickly as possible."
Yeager looked up and saw the look of gravity in both Pitt and Sandecker's faces.
"Max and I are at your disposal. What do you wish me to search for?"
"Check all maritime ship arrivals at major U.S. ports, beginning now and for the next 10 hours, with emphasis on super oil tankers." They went silent as Max's feminine form materialized on her little stage.
"I believe I have what you gentlemen are after. There are several very large crude carriers arriving at several ports, but of the ultra-ultra-large crude carriers, there is one bound for Louisiana from Saudi Arabia, but her mooring terminal is 100 miles from a major city. Another is headed for the offshore pumping station off New Jersey, but she isn't due until tomorrow. And finally, a UULCC bound for Long Beach, California, is still 2 days out to sea. That's the lot."
"So the whole exercise was a waste," murmured Sandecker. "Zale never intended to devastate San Francisco or any other densely inhabited port city."
"Looks that way," said Pitt dejectedly. "But if that's the case, why the subterfuge? What did he have to gain?"
"Did you gentlemen ever consider a different type of vessel?" asked Max.
Pitt looked at her with interest.
"What do you have in mind?" "An LNG ship could do far more damage than a UULCC.
The revelation struck Pitt like a hammer blow.
A liquefied natural gas tanker. One blew up in Japan, back in the 40s with nearly the explosive power of the Hiroshima atomic bomb, Max enlightened them. The death toll ran more than 1,000.
Did you check to see if any are bound for stateside ports? Asked Jaeger.
The Mongol invader, bound from Kuwait, is scheduled to dock in New York at 10:30.
A.M. or P.M.? Asked Sandecker.
A.M.
The Admiral checked his watch. We can eliminate her. She would have docked 20 minutes ago.
Not so, said Max. She was delayed by problems with her generators and had to heave to until repairs were made. She's running 5 hours late.
Pitt and Sandecker exchanged stricken expressions.
That has to be Zale's plan, said Pitt.
Faint with the Pacific Trojan on the west coast and strike New York from the east with the Mongol invader. Sandecker pounded his fist against the table.
He caught us napping like diapered infants.
There's not much time to stop her before she reaches the lower bay and heads into the Narrows, said Max.
Jaeger asked, who owns her?
I traced her pedigree through a facade of paper companies that led to the doorstep of the Cerberus Empire.
Anyone gazing at a liquefied natural gas tanker would have found it hard to believe that such a grotesque-looking ship could ever cross the oceans. The Mongol invader, with 8 bulbous tanks rising from the upper half of her hull, was the largest LNG tanker ever built. Strictly utilitarian and painted an adobe brown, she had to be one of the ugliest ships afloat. Her architects had designed her to envelop, support, and protect her 8 immense insulated aluminum cargo tanks that right now were full of liquid propane that should have been refrigerated to a temperature of about minus 265 degrees Fahrenheit. But on this trip from Kuwait, the temperature had been gradually raised until it was only 20 degrees below the danger level. Unlike on the Pacific Trojan, no crew could be seen exploring the Mongol invaders' tanks or walking the long runway across their domed roofs. They remained unseen in their action stations. There were only 15 of them scattered throughout the ship. 4 operated the controls in the wheelhouse, 5 ran the engine room, while the remaining 6 were armed with portable missiles that could sink the largest Coast Guard cutter or bring down any aircraft that might attack. The Vipers were supremely confident they could prevent any attempt to stop them before the ship entered the outer reaches of the city. And once they passed under the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, it was even money whether the commander in charge of the intercept operation would risk igniting a massive fireball. Leaning over the railing of the starboard bridge wing, Omo Kanai observed the cars moving over the bridge. He noted on the instrument console that brisk 20-knot winds were blowing from the southeast, all the better to expand the killing distance of the fireball, he thought. The thought of thousands of incinerated victims never entered his mind. Kanai was immune to death and had no hesitancy about facing it when his turn came. His second-in-command, Harmon Kerry, a tough-looking customer with tattoos running up and down his arms, stepped onto the bridge from below.
"It won't be long now," he said with more than a hint of pleasure. "The Americans are in for a nasty surprise."
"No surprise," Kanai muttered. "Not if they realize by now that the Pacific Trojan was a decoy."
"Do you think they're wise to the operation?"
"Zale has yet to come up with a flawless plan," Kanai said flatly.
"The 5 hours we were delayed by generator problems cost us dearly, and you can bet they'll be better prepared this time."
Admiral Dover had flown in aboard a Navy fighter jet from the Alameda Naval Air Station right after Sandecker's alert. An NYPD helicopter flew him over to the Sandy Hook Coast Guard station, where 2 fast 110-foot patrol cutters were waiting for his arrival to intercept the Mongol invader. Dover nodded silent greetings to the 10 men and 2 women clustered in the room as he walked to the head of the conference table. He wasted no time on niceties.
Have the New York police aerial patrols flown over the ship?
A police captain who stood along one wall nodded.
We have a copter on station as we speak. He reports that the tanker is running at full speed toward the harbor.
Gentlemen, Dover said, you've all been briefed over the phone and fax by Admiral Sandecker in Washington and know what to expect. If we can't turn it away, it must be sunk. A Coast Guard commander off to Dover's side spoke.
Sir, if we fire into the tanks, we could very well turn her into one immense explosion. The entire flotilla of intercepting boats and helicopters could be caught in the fireball.
Better 1,000 than 1,000,000, Dover replied curtly. But under no circumstances are you to fire forward of the stern superstructure. If the crew refuses orders to heave to, then I will have no choice but to call in U.S. Navy fighters to destroy the ship with air-to-surface missiles. In that event, everyone will be warned in ample time to put as much distance as possible between their vessel and the Mongol invader before combustion occurs.
It doesn't look like any submarine I've ever seen, Giordino remarked, staring at a sleek vessel that looked more like a luxury yacht than an undersea boat.
Pitt stood on the dock at Sheepshead Bay, south of Brooklyn, admiring the 85-foot craft whose exterior styling was that of an elegant powerboat. Giordino was right. Above the waterline, she looked like most any other expensive yacht. The differences were what could be seen underwater. Able to sleep 11 passengers and crew in lavish comfort, the Coral Wanderer was the largest model the Meridian Shipyard of Massachusetts built of the Ocean Diver series. The large, round viewing ports in the forward sides of her hull were similar to those mounted in the hull of the Golden Marlin. Captain Jimmy Flett walked down the stairs from the deck to the dock. He was short and burly, with a face turned ruddy from a long love affair with Scotch whiskey, but his blue eyes had managed to remain clear and bright. He squeezed Pitt's hand to a pulp. Dirk, how long has it been since we trod a deck and drank a Scotch together? On the Arver III, back in 88. The search for the Bonham Richard, said Flett, in a voice surprisingly soft. Pitt introduced Al, then said to Flett, so you've gone soft and become a skipper of luxury boats. I'm a seaman who prefers the surface. Nothing under the water has any interest for me.
Then why do it?
The pay is good and the job is easy. I'm getting old and can't fight the elements the way I used to. As soon as the Coral Wanderer passes all the regulations, I'm scheduled to sail her to Monte Carlo, where her new owners intend to put her out for charter to wealthy Europeans. Pitt then explained the dire situation they were in, adding, this is an extremely critical situation. Flett stared into Pitt's green eyes. What do you want with her? All you said over the phone was that it was a Numa charter. We intend to use her as a torpedo boat. I see, Flett murmured softly. Since the Wanderer doesn't carry torpedo tubes, what have you got in mind?
Did you ever hear of the Confederate submarine, Hunley?
I have.
We're taking a page from her history, Pitt said, with a self-assured smile. 20 minutes later, the three men had mounted a long pipe that acted as a spar and protruded 30 feet in front of the boat's bow. Two more pipes were secured along the deck beneath the raised cabin. Under 3/4 throttles, the Coral Wanderer shot across Sheepshead Bay into the open water toward the Verrazano Bridge. The Coast Guard cutters and a fleet of smaller patrol boats had already spread out across the water ahead of the Wanderer's bow. Overhead, they observed 2 Coast Guard and 2 New York police helicopters circling like vultures above a huge ship painted a dirty buff color. Flett shoved the twin throttle levers to their stops and cut a course that would send the Wanderer on an angle toward the LNG's midships. On board the Coast Guard cutter William Shea, Admiral Dover opened contact with the LNG tanker Mongol Invader.
This is the United States Coast Guard. Please heave to immediately and prepare for boarding.
Dover hailed again, and a third time, but there was no reply.
Then a calm, steady voice said, "Coast Guard, this is the master of the Mongol invader. I have no intention of bringing this ship to a stop. You will be advised that any attempt to damage my vessel will bring dire consequences."
The suspense was suddenly swept away. The horror was real. Dover gave the order for the helicopters to land their anti-terrorist teams on the open deck forward of the tanks. At the same time, he directed the cutters to come alongside with their guns manned. The two Red-Orange Coast Guard modified Dolphin helicopters took up station behind the stern of the LNG tanker as the first blue-black Jayhawk police copter came in low over the bow. The pilot flared out the helicopter only 20 feet above the bow. That was as far as it got. A small missile launched from atop the first tank tore into the helicopter, bursting it open like a firecracker in a tuna can. Kanai watched with detached indifference as the Mongol invader bullied its way through the